Welcome to the This Is Money show. I'm Georgie Frost, and this month is being marked as a 10-year anniversary of the financial crisis. A chain of events between 2007 and 2008 resulted in banks collapsing, huge job losses, and some governments even going bust. So in today's show, I'm joined by This Is Money editor Simon Lambert, who will recall what it was like being a financial journalist at the time, but also reflect on what caused it, what, if anything, we've learned, and ask, as the Queen, speaking for the whole nation at the time, did, why did no one see it coming? And could it happen again?
You know, in a few years' time, when institutional memories start to fade and the people around have all gone and retired, then that's when the risks reoccurs. You always have to be vigilant. The lesson from 10 years ago is something that can start as apparently a small ripple in the water can become, you know, mountainous seas very quickly.
Well, the first milestone came when French bank BNP Paribas froze three hedge funds specialising in subprime loans, something most ordinary folk had never heard of, but we soon would. The ECB injected €95 billion into the markets. The US Fed also added temporary reserves. And all of a sudden, we realised the worries related to the subprime mortgage market weren't going away. Personally, the following month in September, having just moved up to Newcastle as a sports reporter, I found myself interviewing not Sam Allardyce, but queues of people outside Northern Rock. It was a year later, though, when events culminated in the collapse of US bank Lehman Brothers, that the financial car really came off the road. We've since been living in a very long shadow of those events. Regulators, economists, politicians, and those across the finance industry have been trying to make sure that it never happens again. But how successful have they been? Simon, the then Chancellor Alistair Darling, who we heard from a little bit earlier, has been recalling his "where were you when" moment. Now, he was on holiday. He'd walked to the shops to buy bread rolls for breakfast when a cop of the FT apparently stopped him in his tracks. So I want to know, where were you? Firstly, in terms of your financial career, and quite literally, do you remember the moment that he's talking about as something particularly significant? So who were you back in 2007, Simon?
In 2007, I had been working at This Is Money for about 2 years. I was a junior reporter, a reporter there. I mainly covered the property market and some investment stuff, and also wrote about all kinds of different things. I remember that throughout the spring, summertime of 2007, there had been these rumblings of stuff that was going on over in America and some concerns. But it's very difficult with a story like that to try and ascertain exactly how much of these concerns you need to be very, very worried about, especially at a time when most people weren't really digging into this stuff properly. There was a few people who were. Now, what it's also fair to say, though, is that there were lots of people, including us at This Is Money at the time, who were very worried about the level of things like house prices, debt, and just the general atmosphere of what seemed like fairly reckless bank lending going on in the UK. Now, that wasn't the stuff that directly led to the credit crunch, but it's all part of the same picture. And I remember the first time that I ever went on to the television as a representative of This Is Money, and it was to go on ITV because they were doing a section on the news about one of the banks that had been promoting the fact that it would now lend 5 times salary on a mortgage. Mm-hmm. And at that time, banks were falling over to themselves to say, no, we'll lend 4, no, we'll lend 5, no, we'll lend 6. And the first line of that went, up, up, up go the house prices. And it was that classic kind of boom time thing. But there, what was part of that report was not just this bank is promoting that it will lend people even more money, but the questions of, hang on, is this a good idea? But they had a guy come round who was the case study, and as far as he was concerned, this was the only way he was going to get a flat. And this was going on all around the world. So we were coming off the back of this boom period, basically, where everything had been on the up, and everyone thought everything was pretty much fine. There were some people out there saying, stuff's not okay. Then on this day, August the 9th, I do actually remember that day. I do vaguely remember being at work, and all of a sudden, this news emerged that the ECB had pumped this money into the financial system. And that was just weird. It was a moment of, where did that come from? The BNP Paribas stuff, where they effectively shuttered the funds, that was relatively small scale. Mm. But this move by the ECB and then the move by the Fed, that made everyone suddenly wake up and go, hang on, what's going on here? The stock market fell quite a bit in response to it because people were suddenly worried. And I think that was the day that lots of people woke up and went, oh, actually, maybe there's something to this subprime mortgage crisis. Maybe this isn't going away. And I imagine that there were a lot of the great and good of the financial world who were on holiday at the time who suddenly went, whoa, hang on a minute, what's going on here? And there will have been people within those banks who were already quite a bit worried about what was going on with the investments that they had been making.
We'll get onto that in a little while, but fast forward to when I was a newbie jobbing reporter up in Newcastle being put on a story that I quite literally had no idea what I was talking about. What happened from then to then? I've spoken to you in many podcasts over the years, and you always say that there was a point when you were wondering, you're looking around at each other in the office thinking, my God, is another bank going to go? I mean, was it really like that?
Yeah, it was, but that was later on. You've got what's being taken as the 10-year anniversary that we've just had of the start of the credit crunch. Now, that's a little bit false, really, because it wasn't an immediate thing. Mm. It wasn't on August the 8th there was no credit crunch, and on August the 10th there was a credit crunch.
Yeah, why did they pick
the day? Because that was the day that BNP Paribas shuttered these funds and the ECB pumped this money in. It was seen as the day when everyone went, whoa, hang on, actually there is a problem here. The start of it was when everybody started slicing and dicing these bonds and lending this money to people who couldn't pay it back, you know, trading it left, right and centre without really knowing what they were buying and all these other things. And the continuation of it was when effectively what happened was the credit markets froze, banks stopped wanting to lend to each other, and the instance that you're talking about, Northern Rock was pretty much entirely reliant upon money from the money markets that it was getting in order to balance its books so it could just keep growing its lending and lending out more money to people. And infamously, it was the home of the 125% mortgage, which was actually 100% mortgage with a 25% personal loan on top of it. And when the music stopped, it was in trouble. And what happened was, all of a sudden, banks didn't want to lend to each other. Northern Rock had a problem. It suddenly realised that if lots of people tried to take their money out all in one go, it couldn't give it all back to people. And when you had that run on the bank, word got out. I mean, Robert Peston's been credited with causing this, but I think Robert Peston was merely reporting on the fact that there were queues outside of a Northern Rock branch. I mean, what do you do?
I was there, I can prove it.
What do you do if people are queuing outside of a bank branch to get their money out because they're worried about the solvency of the bank? Does everybody just have this conspiracy where they keep quiet and don't tell people? Shh, don't tell people there's people queuing outside that branch. I mean, for a start, you'd never manage to pull that off today because of social media. There'd be photographs all over the place because of it. Back then, you maybe could have done. But even then, it's not realistic. But once that happened and people got word that people were queuing up outside Northern Rock, people started queuing up in other places. And one of the key reasons behind this is because up until the point of Northern Rock, nobody really knew much about the whole savings compensation scheme. So it did exist. People had been vaguely told about it, but nobody paid any attention to it because nobody thought that a bank could go bust in this country in this day and age. And all of a sudden, they woke up to that, and lots of people had more money in that bank than was protected by the compensation scheme. If they'd have all had less than was protected, then theoretically they would have been okay, because if the bank went bust, government would give them their money back. But there wasn't. There's lots of people, things like their life savings, pension lump sums that they'd got, and all of a sudden you got that queue outside the bank. Then this continued on in the March of the following year, in 2008, whilst the Northern Rock saga was rumbling on and the government was doing various things to try and bail it out. Bear Stearns, American investment bank, that effectively went bust in March 2008. And then in September 2008, you had the Lehman Brothers, where that went bust. And then through the autumn of 2008 and the winter of 2009, you had the whole HBOS and RBS scenario, where HBOS had its arranged marriage with Lloyds, was eventually bailed out. RBS was in trouble because it had spent loads of money on ABN AMRO, and then it was eventually bailed out. And that was the period of time, that kind of autumn 2008, winter 2009, when we were looking around going, could Halifax Bank of Scotland actually go bust? Could Barclays actually go bust? Mm. Could RBS actually go bust? Which was would have been unthinkable just over a year earlier. But once the Northern Rock thing had happened, it was no longer unthinkable. And that was the great wake-up that came along with the credit crunch and then the financial crisis, was this suddenly you went from being on one side of the fence where you thought there was no chance that a bank could go bust to being on the other side of the fence where you thought actually there was every chance that it might do. What will happen?
Which I imagine if you were thinking that and the public were thinking that, also so too Mervyn King, so too Alistair Darling. Hindsight's a wonderful thing, and when people question about whether you should bail out banks or not, it must have been a very difficult time
Yes, because there's you know, all kinds of questions surrounding, as Mervyn King famously discussed, moral hazard. By bailing out the bankers, you are effectively seeing them not punished for failure. One of the reasons why we ended up bailing out the banks in the way that we did was because we were scared of what would happen if we allowed a bank to collapse. And what happened when Lehman Brothers collapsed is the financial system pretty much completely froze up. So actually, they thought they could get away with allowing Lehman to collapse, and actually it turned out they couldn't. But also this important point where they didn't think that they could allow ordinary savers' deposits to go under. So never underestimate the power of the ordinary saver. And if you suddenly had ordinary savers whose money was wiped out. Now, the great irony of that is that by bailing out the banks, we then took all of what should have been their failure, and a failure for their shareholders and a failure for their bondholders, etc., onto national books, and has then sort of caused the continuation of the financial crisis, where the debts of private companies then became the colossal debts of, you know, sovereign nations, and then led to austerity and all those other things. But you can trace all of this back to this thing called the credit crunch.
Exactly. I wanted to ask you about the credit crunch, because people seem to use it interchangeably. Credit crunch, financial crisis, what are they? Explain it to us.
So the credit crunch, if you go back to before that, you had the whole subprime boom in America.
Oh, you're going to have to explain this, because you've said subprime a fair few times.
So subprime mortgages were mortgages that were lent to people with effectively dodgy credit records or dodgy borrowing prospects. And what was going on was there was an awful lot of cheap money sloshing around the world, or money that was looking for a home where it could make returns. And people came up with the idea that if you, instead of just simply lending money to people as a bank for mortgages and then took it back off them in the form of repayments, which was a profitable but fairly simple business, if instead of doing that, you lent them the money and then you turned the loans that you had given them into an investment vehicle that you could then sell off to investors, you could get those loans off your books, make some money from selling it off to investors, earn a fee, the investors would get the income back from it. And if you bundle together different types of mortgages, then you could theoretically make what looked like unsafe loans safe, because you could take some safe loans and mix it with some unsafe loans.
So people who pay back their bills regularly, mix to people who don't,
yeah,
stuff it all
so
together.
So people with better prospects and people with other prospects. Yeah. So you slice and dice, put it all together, and then you turn it into a what was called a SIV, special interest vehicle, basically. And then you effectively sold that to people. You sold bonds in it to people. You sold a share in it to people. People owned a slice
and
of
no
that.
And no one actually knew what was in and those bonds.
But
right?
Nobody really knew what was in there. Now, this is the thing that is explained in wonderful detail in The Big Short. Okay, and I cannot do the author of the original book of that or the people who made the film justice. But what happened was, because this turned out to be quite successful and everyone was making money, there was loads of demand for this stuff. So it was literally like, hey, you got any more of that good stuff? Sell me some more of that good stuff. Well, we don't have any more of that good stuff because we've kind of given as many mortgages to as many people as we possibly can. Well, hey, is there anybody else we could give a mortgage to? Yeah, but they don't look that good a borrowing prospect. Well, that's all right. If we just mix them up with this, and if we do that and that, it worked last time. House prices are going up. And this belief that house prices couldn't possibly fall across the whole of America at the same time because that hadn't happened before was another thing that was going on there. The financial world genuinely believed that it was so clever that it had effectively managed to get rid of the risk of making mortgage loans to people who had no income, no job, and no assets. And a lot of it was also predicated on the fact that house prices couldn't fall across the US at the same time. Now, to us in the UK, that second bit sounds completely bonkers. Like, why wouldn't house prices fall across the country at the same time? You see the chain reaction all the time, but that's because it has happened many times in the UK, whereas in the US it hadn't happened, so they thought it couldn't. Now, what happened was this entire industry grew up around this. Banks were selling this to them and that to them, and investors were buying this, and you got any more of that stuff? Yeah, I'll sell you this, I'll buy you that. Nobody really knew what was in these things that they were investing in.
Shouldn't ratings agencies have had?
Yes, they should have done. But the ratings agencies were taken in by the explanations that were put forward to them by these absolute wizards of the bond world. And if you want to know more about this, read Gillian Tett's book, Fool's Gold. The absolute wizards of the bond world who were saying to them, no, this has made these safe. And so some of these bonds got the kind of investment grade status, the kind of AAA rating that you would normally get on a country that can print its own money's debt. I mean, which is absolutely astonishing. There's someone somewhere in America, you don't know where, you don't know what house they own, they don't have any income, they don't have any job, they don't really have any prospects, but somehow they've ended up as part of this investment that you are making that is theoretically also as safe as a UK government gilt. But the problem was there was so much money rushing into these bonds that it was driving up the price and pushing down the yield. There was lots of demand for them and the supply couldn't keep up. So how do you sell this lower yielding bond to someone who would normally, when they looked at that kind of high risk bond, go, well, I need a higher yield than that. Well, maybe you get it rated as a better grade. And the ratings agencies believe this. Now, the problem was that this was absolutely fine, as most of this stuff is, while everything is going swimmingly. However, when the cracks start to emerge, house prices started to fall in this instance, people started defaulting on these bonds, people started getting a little bit worried about them. The problem was nobody knew who was holding what in this whole gigantic investment and banking world. And they didn't even know what they held. So they were not only worried about losses for others, they were also worried about losses for them. They don't want to lend money to their fellow bank because they're worried they're going to be on the hook for a load of money. Well, what have they got? What have they bought? Who knows? I don't know. Can you find out what they've got? But then they didn't want to lend money to other banks because they thought they might have the same unexploded bomb sitting in their basement. Well, what have we bought? Who's in charge of this? Who looked at this? Who found out what was going on there? And if, again, to go back to the Big Short, the reason why those guys made loads of money betting against those bonds, and some of them nearly lost all their money because the market was nearly stupid enough for longer than they could remain solvent, was that they actually drilled into the details of those bonds and effectively discovered that they were junk. So what happens when all the banks won't lend to each other? Well, credit dries up. There's a credit crunch. And the problem is that the economy needs credit to move around. It's the grease that keeps moving the wheels. If you think about what people do on a day-to-day basis, you know, buying houses, buying cars, buying sofas, businesses, I need to buy X off you, but I can't pay you the money until I've sold it to him over there. So you lend me some money to do that and so on and so on. I need to borrow some money to expand my factory and all those other things. When credit dries up, there is no more grease for the wheels and that economic activity stops. Now, you couple that with the importance of the housing market and the big loans that banks have to the housing market. If that's all sinking at the same time, you have a seriously big problem because the banks suddenly looking around and going, well, we're worried about house prices falling. And because we're worried about house prices falling, we're not going to lend to this business over here because we need to try and hoard our cash. And so what you got was this crunch. The whole thing just went crunch and started to seize up. And there are arguments that central banks didn't get on top of it quickly enough.
But why is it that what happened in America impacted or led to the run on Northern Rock, led to what happened in Iceland, led to this whole global issue?
Firstly, you have to remember that what happened in America didn't just happen in America and we had nothing to do with it. A substantial amount of the financial engineering involved in this was going on in London. The credit crunch might have involved homes in America, but quite a lot of it was cooked up by some wizards in London as well. But also, Northern Rock was operating by accessing money, by doing exactly what we were talking about was going on with the subprime mortgage bonds. You lend out some money, you bundle it up, you sell it on to investors. You lend out some more money, you bundle it up, you sell it on to investors. When the music stops, as it did for Northern Rock, it was entirely reliant on continuing that circle going in order to keep its business model going. And when the music stopped, it was in trouble.
Simon, how was all of this allowed to happen? In a system which is based, we thought, on trust?
Well, because essentially it was a combination of greed, hubris, and just people deciding that everything was going absolutely swimmingly and so you'd better join the party. So the greed involved people desperately trying to make more and more money, thinking that they could keep making more and more money, but also involved the people who were borrowing the money as well. You've got to remember that the people were borrowing this money. The hubris involved this belief by the great and the good of the financial world that they had somehow managed to magic away all of the risk involved in this scenario and that things couldn't possibly go wrong. and that everything going swimmingly, we'd better get involved, was just going on all over the place. Because, hey, who sees a party going on and decides that they don't want to join the party?
Yep, the party stopped, as you said, it crunched. And I remember, one thing I do really remember is images of Americans, particularly, living in tents. I mean, this materially impacted people immediately afterwards. But we're talking about this 10 years on, in this very low interest rate environment, money still being pumped around. How has this materially impacted the lives of your readers? Everybody around this country, everybody around the world, but let's focus on here.
Well, I mean, to go back to the party metaphor, it's like a colossal hangover, ultimately. What happened was that once all this credit dried up, obviously the economy ground to a halt. There was a threat of recession. The recession didn't actually arrive for a while, but that's what tends to happen with recessions. But economic activity dries up. People start losing their jobs. They see their homes fall in value. So house prices from the sort of August 2007 peak to February 2009 fell 20% in this country. The FTSE All Share from the summer 2007 peak to the low in March 2009 fell 47%. Now, these are all things that have massive impacts on people's confidence. But what really hurts people is when people start losing their jobs and losing their income. Now, the thing that stood us in very good stead in this country was that we slashed interest rates down very, very quickly to a very, very low level. And an awful lot of weight was put on the bank's shoulders, who you've got to bear in mind at that point were being bailed out by the taxpayer, to show forbearance on people who were struggling with their mortgage, i.e. don't repossess their home. And that saved us an awful lot of trouble for a number of reasons. One, the main reason why people would have come a cropper financially is because they couldn't afford their mortgage anymore, because their income fell or they lost their jobs. So that's when you suddenly start to get the kind of 1990s scenario of mass repossessions. But because mortgage rates came down, standard variable rates came down with the cutting of the bank rate, it managed to knock a lot of money off people's mortgages. So it took a lot of people out of that equation who would have otherwise been in real trouble. It also hugely benefited one part of the British economy where actually there could have been a serious problem, which was buy-to-let mortgages, where lots of people have bought new-build buy-to-let flats or bought buy-to-lets, but they were interest-only. A lot of those rates were actually tracker rates, and so they fell automatically, and there's lots of people who would have lost money there. They ended up with flats that were worth less than they'd paid for them, but they could keep up the mortgage payments. And it turned out that actually the flexibility of our labour force did us a bit of a favour, because companies went to people and said, will you take a pay freeze, will you take a pay cut, will you take lower hours to keep you in work? And that all helped us through. But the impact down the line ultimately was austerity. We saw the nation's debt and deficit balloon because we were spending all of this money on bailing out the banks. And the impact of that has been that now, in order to balance the books again, we had two choices. You either up people's taxes or you cut spending. And we've upped people's taxes a little bit and tried to hack back at spending. And ultimately, that leads through to cuts in public services and cuts in things that people feel that they need and they want. It's worth pointing out that we've felt that much less in this country than many other European countries have felt it. I mean, Greece is the extreme example. Spain, very, very high unemployment. Places like France have had very high unemployment as well. Italy has really struggled. And over in the US, a lot of people lost their homes. But in the US is a slightly different scenario where you can hand back the house in most cases and you're not on the hook for the debt, whereas in the UK you hand back the house, and if the bank sells the house for less than your mortgage, it can still come after you for the gap in the middle. So in the US you have this phenomenon known as jingle mail, where people put their keys in an envelope and then just drop it through the door of the bank.
I mean, you've mentioned a lot of changes that have happened, certainly in terms of policy, but what has come in specifically in terms of the finance industry, in terms of banks and the regulators, to make sure that this doesn't happen again?
To put it in the simplest terms, banks now have to hold more money against the loans that they are making, so against the size of their balance sheet, to try and rein them in slightly from becoming just lending and lending and lending and lending and keeping only a teeny tiny tiny amount of capital in reserve to deal with, you know, bad times. So if bad times come, those banks are theoretically much safer. There are more firewalls in place between certain parts of their activity. There is also a situation that occurred in 2007 where Alistair Darling said, and I think the guy who's now in charge of the FCA, said there wasn't really actually any sort of method in place for dealing with a failing bank. Whereas now we have got lots of plans as to how you wind down a failing bank. So we've gone from the position of, we need to bail out this bank, what do? To this is what we do in this scenario. And now you have this bank bail-in scenario where, in theory, the bank, if it goes bust, basically anybody who is exposed to that bank in the sense of the shareholders, the bondholders, or the people who've got money in it that is above the savings compensation deposit scheme allowance would have their money put back into the bank to essentially try and salvage the bank. And also we've seen the scenario where you have had bank problems, the regulator steps in, quickly gets that bank sold off to someone else, shifts everything over, safeguards everything. So just the reaction to it is much better. And people are looking out for what's going on. There are a lot more people paying a lot more attention. 2006, 2007, there weren't a lot of people paying attention to what was going on.
But if so much of what you were saying was down to greed, down to hubris, down to human foibles, have we done anything that's changed that? Can you see that any of that has changed? Because whenever I read out articles, it's always talking about we're back to pre-crisis levels, as though it's a target that we need to aspire to. But surely we need to change the way that we think about the whole process.
Yes, and I think that this is the problem, is that whilst we've done lots of things in terms of the financial system and the financial regulators to deal with maybe a lot of the more technical bank-related, business-related stuff, I don't think that we've really solved many of the problems that actually were underlying this. We still have a huge amount of debt, very, very high house prices. We have people taking on very, very big mortgages, which are essentially justified on the fact that interest rates are low. We still have gigantic banks, and we have had very, very low interest rates that are encouraging people to take all kinds of risks that maybe they shouldn't be taking and blowing asset bubbles left, right and centre. And we see problems emerging in places like car finance and things like that, where I think essentially the problem was through the bulk of, well, probably after about 2003 through to about 2007, is that lots of people were just living beyond their means and they were funding it with borrowed money. And I still look at the scenario today and see lots of people living beyond their means and funding it with borrowed money. So in that sense, no, we haven't learned our lesson.
And in that sense, can we therefore not rule out another financial crisis?
No, you could never rule out another financial crisis. And I think that loops back all
the
way to the start.
On the scale of what we saw?
Loops back all the way to the start of why did that credit crunch occur? Why did that financial crisis occur? Because we thought we'd ruled out the possibility of a financial crisis. So for as long as we still think there could be another financial crisis, it's probably less likely that we will get one. It's the day when we stop thinking that there will be another one that we're more likely to get one. There are some people out there who argue that we are going to get another financial crisis probably in, you know, 3 to 5 years' time, and it's going to be even worse than the last one due to all kinds of the problems involving, you know, the huge amount of personal debt, mortgage debt, sovereign debt. There are others who argue that the world is a safer place. I don't know what the answer is.
On a slightly more philosophical and hopefully positive end, Simon, I do want to ask you what you think this has done for the psyche of individuals and indeed the country. But the fact we seem, and maybe I'm wrong, to be talking about money. We seem to be taking a bit more responsibility, wanting to delve in a little bit more deeply to the way things work now. Is that fair?
Yeah, it is. And I think that we are much more savvy about our money now than we probably were 10 years ago. I think there's many more people interested in what's going on, many more people interested in trying to understand what's going on behind the things that they see, who are a lot more questioning of things. I think there's a very long way to go, but I mean, we know it from our readership, which has gone up substantially over that time. But that's not just to do with financial crisis, that's to do with the internet and all kinds of other things. But, you know, I think that there are definitely more people who are more interested in their finances and a younger generation coming up who are much more switched onto it. Unfortunately for that younger generation coming up, the aftermath of the financial crisis means that they are not going to benefit from lots of the things that older generations did. You only have to look at the situation around student loans and house prices to learn the lessons of that.
Editor Simon Lambert, thank you so much. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk, follow us on Twitter, or download the app.